Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, a podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Stuart Welsh.
Hello, Kieran. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to explore the principles of counting. But first, Stuart, what are you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
Well, Kieran, I've been looking through a few different papers recently, and something that I was reading is titled The Effects of Internal Feedback on the Perception of Negative Feedback. So this is a paper by Helena Laudel and Suzanne Narcisse. And really, they were sort of trying to look in detail at when students receive what they're calling negative feedback, although I would suggest perhaps constructive feedback, but feedback that says your work is not so good. How is the response of the student affected by whether the students get an opportunity to sort of look at their work beforehand and sort of form their own conclusions that the work isn't so good? So before receiving the specific feedback from the teacher, the students are almost self-assessing their work against the criteria. And then the study was designed to look at how those students then responded in a sort of emotional sense. How receptive were they then to the teacher's feedback? And did it make any difference whether they'd first had a chance to kind of self-assess? And then the second part of the study was then, and how did that affect subsequent response to the feedback? And so the study seemed to show that there was an impact of giving students the opportunity just to sort of judge their own work against the success criteria, first of all, in that they seemed better prepared for this sort of negative feedback. They seemed ready to accept that I need to improve, and they were more willing to take that on board. But what the study didn't show was that it then actually modified their behaviors beyond that point. So they were, let's just say, they were in a better mood. They were more positive when they received their negative feedback, but yet they didn't actually do anything different in terms of how they would act in that feedback. So I think takeaways for teachers there are, yes, we should really pay attention to that sort of subtle point where we're giving back students constructive feedback, which may be perceived as negative. We might be able to reduce that negative perception by giving them a chance to first look at their work and sort of come to the conclusion themselves that I need to improve, but that we should still also focus as teachers. For all students, we should focus on encouraging them and giving them a sort of framework to then act on that feedback and helping them scaffold it in that way. So it was an interesting study, I suppose. Nothing hugely surprising, but it just made me think, you know, maybe we can really focus in on the actual delivery of that feedback. And if we can sort of prime the students to receive it in a more positive light, but then continue to support them when it comes to actually acting on that feedback. And you, Kieran, what are you reading for?
That sounds fascinating. And I think I'm probably going to check it out too. But I've got one that's been recommended by Chris Such before. It's called The Role of Background Knowledge in Reading Comprehension, A Critical Review. And it's by Reed Smith, Pamela Snow, Tanya Seri, and Lorraine Hammond. And I think regular listeners, if they are interested, should check this paper out over the next week or so, because you know, we might have something very interesting with regards to the role of background knowledge coming up for you.
Well, Kieran, that sounds intriguing, and I'm sure everybody is now on the edge of their seat waiting to find out what you mean by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty much open access. It's on ResearchGate, so it's not hard to find. Definitely worth checking out.
Oh, I'll have a look at that for sure.
So this week, Stuart, we're going to look at the principles of counting, and the wheels or the tables are going to be turned. You're going to take on the role of bumbling fool that I normally take on and throw some questions, because I think counting is something that gets underestimated. And, you know, being a secondary teacher, you expect pupils are able to count by the time they come to you. So it might be, a point in your knowledge that you're keen to develop. And so, yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited by the prospect of taking the hot seat. I'll do my best to emulate the bumbling fool. And you're absolutely right. With a secondary background, only in very, very, very rare occasions, really, have I met pupils that are not able to count. And so when secondary teachers think towards the work that their colleagues do in primary schools, I think they quite often just get this sense that, the students will come to secondary being able to count, and there's something that goes on that equips them with this ability to count. But it wasn't until 2 or 3 years ago that my eyes started to be opened, not only to the fabulous work that primary teachers do in teaching all the content that they deliver, never mind the mathematics, but then into this real sort of fine level of detail about counting, and in particular the principles of counting. And coming from that secondary background, as I said, my eyes are opened here to see just the level of detail and the importance of getting this foundation right. So obviously, counting is key to future mathematics success, but this teaching of these principles of counting and equipping those students is really nuanced and fascinating. So I would encourage colleagues, whichever sector you work in, whether you're primary or secondary phase, to really think deeply about these principles. And we've got this opportunity here to sort of interrogate Kieran and find out a little bit more about it. So I'm going to be learning as we go along today, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I suppose we should probably kick off with the big question up front. Kieran, what are the principles of counting?
Good question. I mean, depending on where you read or who your source of inspiration is, there can be as many as 15 I've seen. But I think the accepted wisdom is that there are five principles of counting. And for me, three of them are essential to counting, and two of them come about through more counting, if that makes sense. So the sort of three that comprise counting for me are the one-to-one correspondence principle, the idea that you can assign a value of one to one object, to one thing, is important because it's that first step into enumeration. You're assigning a value to something, and it makes sense that we start with a one-to-one correspondence, because when we have almost like a one-to-many correspondence, things can get quite complex quite quickly, and pupils tend to struggle with it, regardless of what age they are. So you get the one-to-one principle, one object, value of one. You've got the stable order principle, the idea that the number names are have been assigned in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, in perpetuity and reverse, and that order can't be changed. That order is stable, and I think that's essential. Because pupils need to understand that that pattern will continue no matter what they're counting. And then the sort of the final one, the one that most people perceive as counting, is the idea of cardinality, the cardinal principle. And that's the fact, or the idea, that the last number you say during a count is the value of the group. And so if I count 1, 2, 3, three is the final number I've counted, there must be three objects here. And essentially, once you have a sense of those three principles, you can count whatever you want. And so you understand the order of the numbers you're counting. You understand that each of the objects has a value of one. And then you know that the last number you say during that count is the value of the group. And so you can count, for all intents and purposes. And then sort of the next two are the abstraction principle. The idea that anything can be counted, regardless of their nature, and the order irrelevance principle. It doesn't matter what order I count these things in. Quite often it's easier to count things in a straight line, but there will be times when we need to count things that are sort of spread out and stuff. And so I think by understanding the first three principles, the more you count, the more you can develop the sense of abstraction. And the more you can develop a sense of order relevance, because once you've got the tools, you could just go off and count whatever you want. And kids seem to do that, I think, quite naturally.
That is a fascinating introduction, I think, Kieran. And as you say, there are different sources that might suggest sort of different principles of counting. But those five that you mentioned, and particularly the first three, the one-to-one principle, stable order principle, and the cardinal principle, I can really see why they are important in a sort of student's learning. But I see young children sometimes with their parents, and they're starting to sort of recite the number names, and I think most people would say, well, as long as you understand that cardinal principle, then you can count. I mean, is that true, or why should we focus so much detail on these individual principles? Why should students be learning them to this level of sort of detail and understanding?
I don't know if I could put my finger on research that definitely shows that counting is almost like a biologically primary sort of phenomenon. But part of me thinks it is evolutionarily advantageous to be able to count. We've talked in the past about how subitizing was definitely advantageous because you can get a sense of how many hyenas are over there, so you can scarper in the opposite direction. Because lots of children seem to develop a sense of cardinality, a sense of these principles, just through their interactions with the world. But it's important for us to go into this level of detail, because when people don't have those experiences, we need to know exactly what it is we can do to support them in developing, a sense of counting, an ability to count. Because essentially, if you don't across this bridge, the whole of mathematics is closed to you, and very few people actually don't learn to count. But those who struggle to learn to count, when we don't support them with a very specific focus, it makes that journey all the more difficult, because if you're struggling to count when you're 5, 6, 7 years of age, you know what that trajectory is for when you're 16 years of age. You'll be working on your number bonds, and that's not an enjoyable place to be, I don't think.
I couldn't agree more. The importance there of unlocking future mathematics by having that deep and sort of secure understanding of being able to count. So interestingly, I mentioned young children sometimes with their parents maybe saying, look, young Kieran here is learning to count, and Kieran's dutifully trots out 1, 2, 3, 4, and everybody thinks this is going well, and Kieran goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 9. 99, 10,000, and you start to think maybe the wheels have come off the counting wagon there. But you said sort of ages 5 and 6, and then we're thinking, but is there a sort of biologically primary element at play here? So then, at what age does it start to develop, and what age should we be teaching students about counting and the principles of counting? When in their journey should they be learning this? Before school, with parents, in school?
You've mentioned twice the idea of pupils being able to say the numbers, and sometimes kids will count way up, into the double and triple digits. So I think recitation precedes enumeration, and so there's a lot of value in parents singing songs, going, I don't know what the verb is, but taking part in rhymes with their kids, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Once I caught a fish alive, the famous nursery rhyme. And it's important, to develop the stable order, those kind of songs. You almost the increments or the range increases, so you might have it that very young children are developing this understanding within three, so it's 1, 2, 3, some of the rhymes, like wind the bobbin up. I think you clap 1, 2, 3. Whenever you finish winding the bobbin up, then you'll move into within five. And then by the time you're in reception, you're singing those rhymes within 10, and there's no reason you can't sing them before that. But there seems to be this natural pathway where, you're working within three, working within five, you're working within 10. And so I think any activity that involves counting can be tweaked to focus on a particular principle. But I think if parents are singing rhymes and counting in the real world with their people, with their children, that's sufficient preparation. If you're playing snakes and ladders and you're modeling, you move your thing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's when kids pick this stuff up, because it means something to them. Because they're playing this all the time, it's repeated exposure. You're singing the songs, and so you have this platform on which teachers can build, I think. So yeah, so I think the distinction between recitation and enumeration is important because one is confused for the other, but one, as far as I can tell, I think it's Ian Thompson talks about this, it was maybe 20 or 30 years ago, recitation precedes enumeration. So it's an essential part of the journey. And if you've done those kind of things when you're very small, the stable order principle should be sort of there whenever you go into nursery, whenever you go into reception, depending on when you start school.
So it does seem that even before school, there's definitely a role that the adults in around a young child can play in helping to develop the ability to count. And when you're talking about those rhymes, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, once I got fish alive, that was, you know, a staple for me when I was going through school. And you talked about moving pieces maybe on a game board and counting 1, 2, 3 moves, perhaps even, you know, counting objects. It feels to me that there's definitely an importance to be placed on having something physical or visual to hang your count on, rather than just perhaps sort of, you know, rote learning the number names. Although, as you say, that recitation is important there, because without it, you don't have the ability to put words on these numbers. So I talked there just saying about young children looking very, it looks very promising. They're counting up to 3 and then suddenly 7, 13, 24. But that's just my naive, you know, observations. What are some other common mistakes or misconceptions that students have or form when they're learning to count?
I knew there was a second part that I had forgotten to answer there. I mean, I think with regards to the confusing numbers, I think you can't really explore any sort of diagnosis or anything until pupils are like 7 or 8 years old. You know, generally educational psychologists will say this is a perfectly normal part. You know, it's like forming letters backwards. You're not going to get assessed for dyslexia and before you're 7, you know. And so reversing the numbers, miscounting, totally normal. I mean, Dylan for a long time would skip 14. You know, he could count to 20, but he would refuse to say 14. And yeah, so but he's now what is he? He's 6. And he's grown out of that, so to speak. You know, he's working comfortably with 3-digit numbers. So it is totally normal, so it's not to get worried about. I mean, the big one is the miscount. In as much as, you know, we want this one-to-one correspondence, we want pupils almost, you know, moving the objects as they count. And sometimes 2 objects can be moved and a value of 1 assigned to them. You know, so you count the first one, move it over, that's 1. Then you take 2 over, that's 2. And then from there, you've already, you know, the miscount is guaranteed, you know. So I think, yeah, in terms of, because misconceptions are overgeneralizations, so it's probably more a case of common errors. And so pupils find different types of count more or less difficult. So I mentioned a straight line, that's typically considered the easiest. And a circle is typically considered the most difficult, because you've really got to be cognizant of where you stop and where you started in the count. And sometimes you will see children going round and round and round as they go through. And probably in between that, you've got, you know, sort of sporadic distribution of objects and stuff. So it's more a case of when are errors more likely. And it's often when they're not paying full attention to what it is, or the presentation of whatever it is that's being counted, you know, because we think about the ways in which pupils count. They very much start by touching things, but then they should at some point be able to just point at it, and then should just be able to look at it. I always think about the roof tiles in school. You know, that's like the furthest thing away from the pupil. And if they can go across and count those, then they've sort of graduated into this, I can just look at stuff, you know. And I think to varying degrees, we as adults, we will do things depending on how much of our attention is spent elsewhere, you know, because you and I are both reasonably good at mathematics, but I don't know, sometimes I'll count days of the week on my fingers just to make sure I get the, is that, so today's the 24th, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Okay, all right. I mean, making sure. I don't know if you do that. I mean, I'm pretty sure I've seen you do that. So we count in different ways for different reasons, and pupils should be going through this. So yeah, in terms of misconceptions, I'm sure there probably are lots that are documented, but most of them are just common errors that come from a lack of attention or from pupils just going through that cycle.
Again, that is really, really interesting. And I think I'm starting to form in my mind now a bit of an understanding of a sort of sequence here. So you've talked about moving objects being counted, maybe from the uncounted area to the counted area. So we've got a kind of scaffold in there, a support. You talked about touching objects. You talked about objects in a straight line. So and then we can sort of then confuse the structure a little bit. And it just made me start thinking, like, I can see that gradual release towards just stopping touching, maybe just pointing, and then stopping pointing, just focusing your attention. And then I'm thinking that you sometimes see online people posting images of, I don't know, a blueberry cheesecake with a number of blueberries on the top. It's how many are there and how did you count them? And then I think as math teachers, we quite enjoy doing that. I sometimes have to get my socks off as well, Kieran, not just fingers, but toes as well for the blueberry cheesecake. But I mean, we're really laying the foundations for that further skill, which combines, I suppose, subitizing. You're looking for groups and patterns, and but you juggling these numbers in your working memory, using your number bonds towards the end. But here we are, right at the very beginning of that journey. So it's definitely, making me think about the importance of this. And the other thing was making me think, do these principles all happen at the same time, or do they get taught in a sequence? Is it best to do them in any particular order? How does that look? Can they be taught concurrently, or how do we approach that?
It's probably impossible to isolate one particular thing, but you can focus attention on a particular principle. The first one that, we talked about those rhymes, we talked about those songs. The stable order, in the right environment is developing from zero, because you're hearing those songs, you're having those songs sung to you, lots of the rhymes have grown up out of these, out of this idea that we want pupils to know this order. And so I think that's already happening from a young age, probably the first one. Then we're going to be looking at, one-to-one correspondence is important before you can identify a sense of cardinality, because the cardinal value you assign will be erroneous if you have not assigned a value of one to one to each of the objects, if that makes sense. And so you're probably moving towards cardinality after you've explored the stable order and the one-to-one principle. But like, I mean, I think Helen Williams talked about sort of counting in and counting out activities when she was on Craig Barton's podcast. This was quite a while ago now. But like, if you want to develop cardinality, it's getting pupils to count things into your hand. How many have we got here? And then counting them back out. How many have we got here? Just repeated opportunities to go through the process. And your focus in that instance would be on what's the final number I say. But equally, it might be that we focus on just taking one out at a time. If we notice that we want to focus on the one-to-one principle, well, it might be a case of, as the adult, you take responsibility for the card for assigning the cardinal value, but we make sure that one goes out and we count one together, one, two, three. It's almost that immediate correction of the pupil's count. That's probably the best way to mitigate some of those misconceptions. And that's, it's where do we focus our attention when we're getting pupils to count things, and sometimes we'll want them to go off and we'll want them to bring back a certain amount, and so we've got less control over the one-to-one, but we're almost giving them more responsibility for all of the process, so depending on how involved you are and how sort of scaffolded the count is, I think that helps you to focus on things, and because if the people were to say one, two, three, four, seven, Well, then you would immediately go, let's try that again. And then you would take more responsibility for the count if it were the stable order that was causing an issue, you know. So I think, yeah, we focus our attention. Counting activities are counting activities, but it's perhaps our involvement that shapes which of the principles we're focused on. But I do think they develop together. But at certain points, you will know which of the principles a pupil has not yet established. And I think this is normally like when I go into reception classrooms and the teachers aren't aware of this, it's a watershed moment for them because pupils who previously couldn't count, they can then see how they can help them count. You know, and so you might have these kids who are almost 5 years old, have really been struggling with counting, and now the teacher's equipped with the knowledge of the principles of counting. They can choose where to focus pupil attention during the activities. I think, you know, something you said just before the last one, you know, board games like Snakes and Ladders, they have each of those squares has a cardinal value. And, you know, Bernie Westacott always talks about the distinction between the cardinal value of a number track, because essentially a board game is a number track, and the ordinal value of the number line. And so, you know, that kind of thing shows pupils that, you know, this has it helps them develop that one, you know, because if you run a number line, you're describing the position of something, you know, and that's why I tend to keep the number line for like year four or when pupils are like 9, 10 years old, because we're still focusing on this cardinal value, I think.
It's starting to become clear, I think, for me. Something you said there was that it's almost as if the sort of tasks and activities can be the same throughout this process, but that it's the way we use them, the way we focus students, the support that we give, that we can change depending on which of the principles we're focusing on, or which of the principles have revealed themselves to have those kind of common mistakes that the students are struggling with. And so then going back to the blueberries on the top of the cheesecake there, the sort of third and the fourth and fifth principle. So the order irrelevance principle, that idea that the order in which we do the count doesn't affect the final total. That's kind of the blueberries, I suppose. And then that abstraction principle, so just any set of objects. Because I think quite often, perhaps students might see, you know, five identical images of a dog or something, or five identical kind of stars, and just counting those. But it could be, you know, how many birds, and then you've got different images of different birds, whatever. That's the abstraction principle, I think. So do they just naturally kind of come into play once the first three are becoming secure, and we just change the task, and we change the size of the images, or the different images, or the arrangements? Is that how we would sort of help students understand those final two?
We said we weren't going to dive into the world or the relationship between literacy and maths, but it feels like these two are akin to reading for vocabulary development. You know, you've learned the code, read more, pick up more knowledge of reading, get better at reading. And for me, once you've got the first three, once you can assign a value of one, once you know the stable order, once you can assign a cardinal value, the more you count, you know, the better your counting's going to get, you know, and you're going to self-correct and stuff like that there. So I think, yeah, it's very much a case of the more counting we do, once we're equipped with those tools, then we can go off and we can just count, and pupils love counting stuff all the time, you know. And I think we can encourage them to count things, you know, snack time, you know, lunchtime, when we're doing the register in school, you know, when we're climbing up steps. I mean, you've got loads of steps beside your house here, so any children around there will be, you know, fluent to, you know, be able to the stable order in about 1,000 within a few days. So I think it's that idea. It's that idea that we, the more we count, the broader our range of experiences we count in, the better our counting we become. You know, so I'm less worried about explicit opportunities for those last two, because it's something that will happen. I think once we've focused on the first three, it's normally the first three where pupils are struggling, and that's where we focus our attention. On the blueberries, people normally assign a multiplicative relationship to those counts, don't they? So it's like, oh, I can see, you know, five lots of three within this kick, and they'll sort of draw their little lines over the triangles that they can see and stuff like that there. So it's really interesting. It's almost like this next level, but they're no longer sort of applying additive reasoning to the to their count. But yeah, there's definitely elements of counting within that. So yeah, I mean, I wonder if there's any studies on that. Interesting to see.
That's your homework, Kieran, for next week. So I've got a much clearer understanding of these principles and of the experiences that students might have as they're starting to develop that ability to count, essentially. And throughout our chat here, you've given over, I think, quite a lot of strategies and activities. You know, you've talked about rhymes and songs. You've talked about counting the steps, something that parents, carers can do with their child, something that teachers can do when the children are out and about. And again, board games, something that can be done at home, something that can be done in the classroom. And these all sound like fantastic opportunities to build in that ability to count. Are there any other activities or strategies that, you know, that you really think are very important to build into this experience? Or is it just count as much as, you know, as often as you can to develop that ability?
For me, I probably want people's counting every day in school until they're, you know, in key stage two, and possibly even halfway through key stage two, you know, because then you may focus your attention on sort of multiplication tables, that kind of thing, you know. So I'll have the counting stick in the classroom, and we'll be doing some sort of counting, you know. So I think counting every day in whatever guise is very, very important. And, you know, always trying to recycle activities, so we're not having to make, you know, constantly make new resources. You've almost got, you know, here are the things that we can count, and then make a small tweak to it, and then, you know, go for, you can push on from there. I think thinking carefully about the representations we choose, you know, are they counting within a 5 frame or a 10 frame, you know, because we're almost like foreshadowing some of the sort of the arithmetic and the additive reasoning we'll be exploring later on. And so, yeah, it's very much thinking about what's the principle, how can I foreshadow representations that are important that will support people's understanding, but also how can I make sure that this task works for me as opposed to me working for the task, and going from there. I think, you know, at home, it's very much a case of singing songs and playing games. You know, I think I said that in the episode just before Christmas. That's my sort of mantra when it comes to supporting pupils and parents with mathematics at home. You know, sing songs, play games, and you'll be absolutely fine.
For all of your Ko-fi, Ko-fi, Ko-fu-fu, however you pronounce it, you damn lovely supporters. It's a song going out to you, to you. Septy, Stephanie Taylor, Mrs. B. Esatea, Adam, Katie, Liv Dempsey, Becca, Jenfred, Susie, Brown, and Cio, Neccio, Rachel, I am Al, Jessica, Tom Oakley, Tom Brassington, Jessica, Tom Oakley, Tom Brassington, LJ, and last but not least, my lovely little Amy Bills. Oh, they help us pay the bills. Oh, a massive thank you out to Dabbe family. Ko-fi supporters help us keeping it ad-free. There's far more content coming just round the bend. Thank you all for helping our very special friends. Friends. Very special friends.
Now, thinking about this process, 7 or 8, whatever years down the line, and that they're coming into early sort of secondary school. You know, obviously, we expect them to be using symbols, abstract symbols, to represent these numbers. But when did those appear in the process? When do we start using the actual symbols that we use to represent numbers? When do students start to make that connection between those number names and the counting they've done and the way that we represent them?
This can be quite controversial at times because there can often be a sort of leaning towards in bringing this in too soon. You know, I think we should always be exposing pupils to the symbolic notation. You know, they should be in the world around them. It should be a part of their sort of their experience of number. But I don't think children in nursery reception should be expected to be able to match the value and the symbolic notation. And certainly in the guidance in England, it's very clear that any marks that are made have meaning for the pupils. And I'm pretty sure the research bears that out too. You know, you want there to be opportunities for pupils to label pots and to, you know, sort of assign what they think is a reasonable symbol or symbolic representation of value. But there should be no expectation that early on, you know, because I think pupils probably need to have that, I don't know, in place. I want to say maybe towards the end of year one, you know, when they're almost 6 years old, you know, there's an argument, you know, I think most curricula, most schemes will start at the start of year one, and they will explain the relationship between one, the symbol one, the word one. You know, I mean, I think the English National Curriculum wants people to be able to spell, you know, to be able to spell them, so the numeral as a word. And you know, which is a bit ridiculous because our numbers, they're not typical in terms of the letter and the sign spelling correspondence. So, you know, things like one, that doesn't feel like a, you know, to be on a if we're just breaking it out and stuff. But you know, so there's a bit of a discrepancy between what parts of the phonetic code pupils will have learned and when we expect them to understand numerals, because they go hand in hand, you know. So, I mean, for me, we didn't start formal, inverted commas, mathematics in year one until Christmas. And that's when we would start to introduce these ideas. So we had maybe it's almost like 14, 15 week buffer in which to make sure the fundamentals were in place, you know, sort of embarked on our very ambitious curriculum, you know. So I don't know, I think I've given a politician's answer there, but it's certainly very contested. I think practice doesn't necessarily match up with what the research would suggest, and it may be that we need to have a think as a global mathematics community as to when this is actually necessary, you know, because there are some things you can't perform without understand, be able to manipulate those numerals yourself, those digits. But it's about finding that perfect point, you know. So who knows?
Well, I think your response there, Kieran, just goes to highlight and illustrate just how complicated it all is, even at this very, very early stage when you're putting in those foundations of being able to count at the very beginning of that mathematical journey. The amount of thought and planning and having the ability to modify your strategy, change what you're doing depending on what the pupils are getting or not getting. It's really been a great opportunity for me to sit in and talk to you about this today. I found it really, really fascinating, and I hope that the listeners have done too. I'm sure they have. I appreciate your wisdom here, Kieran, and the opportunity. So until the next time, thank you. Thank you very much for letting me join.
My pleasure. Thank you for being such a gracious host and for really helping us get under the skin of this very, like I say, I think it's very complex, very important aspect of people's mathematical development. And it's all I have to do is say thank you very much, Stuart, for joining me.
You're very welcome. I'm going now for that blueberry cheesecake.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.